Okay, this is a kind of a short notice preparation. I try to make what I can, and I hope it will bring you some kind of insight. The topic of end-of-life care is very important. I would like to begin by addressing some fundamental questions concerning life and also leading towards a Buddhist perspective, sign, and then appropriate Buddhist practice. What we should do for the end-of-life care. There are five fundamental questions in the world which we all face from time to time. Every being in this world questions himself or herself, who am I? What is this world? What is the meaning of my life? What will happen to me after I die? And why did this bad thing happen to me or my loved one when they have problems? This nature of human being found in almost in all culture in the world. Now, when I was at Oxford University for the first hour, there was a tutorial section with the professor asked every student to answer. And that is, can you give me the difference between modern society and traditional society? This notion is, I don't know what is the difference very well, but after years of teaching, I realized that by understanding this notion, the differences between modern society and traditional society allow me to understand more of nature of human being. In modern society, like in America and in Europe, their perception that the past was the worst, the present is better than the past, and the future is better than today. This is what people believe in modern society. And change is good. Society sign is authority. When they decide anything, you must have a scientific argument, data. Egalitarian, everyone is equal, challenging old ideas, and they prefer a simplified version. The simplest one is the best. The outcome is better. The outcome has priority over the process. Truth is only mass and energy, nothing else. Matter and energy. Traditional society, on the other hand, see, the past is the golden age, and then today is worse, and the future is even worse than today. Things are decaying. Therefore, change is bad. Authority is in a sacred text. When you want to argue with someone, you have to base your argument in a sacred text, not science. Hierarchy status prefer people in hierarchy, and in many traditional society, they are very hierarchical indeed. Criticism of authority is bad. When you raise question to the master, it seems to be a challenge, be a an intrusion, you see, more than a challenge. Respect to formality is very high. The process is more important than the outcome. This is traditional society. You have to do all the process. The truth is the mind and the unseen, not the material. In scientific world, our world began with Big Bang, and then our ancestors were apes, and there was a kind of evolution from primitive cells, and then become more sophisticated and complex beings, and then become human being. Mind is a brain process, nothing else. Morality is social values. There's nothing sacred. Nothing exists after life. life is a procreation. The goal of life is procreation of species. Fortune and misfortune is just a coincidence. There is no meaning. Religions, we base our trust in the Genesis. That in every religion, Buddhism included, the story of Genesis and superiority of man over animals and plants, and human and mind habits in the brain. Morality is a part of natural law. Sacredness in the unseen is something sacred which cannot be perceived by the eyes. And the afterlife is sacred and real. Life, the purpose of life, is in search of eternity. Fortune and misfortune, there must be reason behind it. You see, these are the difference. And now, why these different are very important? Because we're going into a twilight zone. Every religion provides two things, model of and model for. Model of is model of reality, what is real, what is important. Then what is real and that is important. And then model for, what is the duty, the goal of our life on earth. In every religion, there are five dimensions. Religion is like a huge single cell protozoa moving around, adapting itself to its settings. But it has five dimensions. The first is myth. Every religion has its myth. And second from myth is ethics and social institution, rituals and religious experience. Every religion has all these five dimensions. When we talk about religion, we have to be aware which part of religion are we talking about. You see, and this is the thing that we can make use at the end when we bring religion into practice. Now there are several kinds of religion. Polytheism, like for example Egyptian religion, ancient Greek religion, and some part of Hinduism. They believe in many gods. Monotheism, like Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and some part of Hinduism. Hinduism can be polytheism and monotheism at the same time. It depends who you talk to and in what context. And non-theistic religion like Jainism, Taoism, Confucianism, and Buddhism. This is non-theistic religion. There is no single authority which create the world, heaven and earth. Death, according to various religion, in the Egyptian Book of Death, there was a judgment where as soon as a person die, that the soul will be brought in front of Orisis, who is the god of death, judging. And his heart will be taken out and put on a scale, and scale on a balance compared to a feather. If it's lighter than the feather, the person go to heaven. If it's heavier, he goes to hell. So in Egyptian Book of Death, there is a very famous painting of the judgment day of a man who died. And probably it could be a part of the earliest thinking of judgment. Then in Hinduism we have, in Sanskrit texts, Upanishads. We have Black Ayurveda, and also a story of Nachiketa. There was a young man who somehow quarreled with his father and then found his way to hell, to a kind of the underworld. He met face to face with God of Death, and somehow he was able to please the god of death to grant him three boons, which he finally decided which was what he wanted to do. As a the three boons represents the goal of life, of what people should have. In Chinese, tradition, there's a belief in twin souls. In when you die, if a Chinese, there are two souls. One is a soul of sin, and one is soul of merit. The soul of sin go to hell, and the soul of merit go to heaven. In Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition, there are descriptions by Dante describing inferno. In Theravada Buddhism, we have Pribhumi Katha, Pratmalai, who describe journey to hell and to other world. Mahayana Buddhism, there are several. Lotus Sutra, Pure Land, Madhyamika Yogacaras also depict different scenes after death. In Shintoism, they believe in spirits and death as a result of evil spirit. Now, when I was at Harvard, I went to a library at the Divinity School, Andover Hall. I was struck by a saying with a text on a piece of paper. It said, when shits happen in world religion. As a gentleman graduate, newly graduated from Oxford, I don't know American slang. And it took me for a while to understand what does tit means. And I found it was a rude word. And the sentence was used in a Hollywood film promoted by Arnold Schwarzenegger. And it means when it explained many things. In Confucius, if you were Confucius, when bad thing happen, when shit happen, people who believe in Confucius will say, Confucius says shit happens. Because Confucius are naturalists. You don't put yourself into interpretation. You take it, what it happened like that. You see, naturalists. You don't give meaning to things unnecessarily. For Hindu, he or she will say, this shit happened before. When you come across stories of a bad thing happening in Hinduism, suddenly there will, in a scene, there will appear a sage, some holy man, a guru appear. There was a sound, a gong or something, and the man appear. And then he revealed the story that this is not the first time. This had been known long ago that a story like this happened, and he revealed. Then Hindus are satisfied with that. This shit happened before. They're not the first victim. For Buddhists, Buddhists say, this shit is your karma. So you blame the victim. For Catholic, you deserve it. It's a predestination of God. For Muslim, this shit comes from Allah. You'll be proud. Nobody give it to you. For Protestants, they will say why it did not happen to other people. Protestants have different theology than Catholic because they feel that they are a selected group. They're the elite, you see. And they were proud to have access to God directly. When bad things happen, they say, why didn't it happen to other people? Produce, why shit always happened to us? And you notice, us is written with capital U, not a small U. For feminists, all shit are from men. But what if you don't believe in anything? Materialism. They seek for something. Death with dignity, right to die, final exit. Final Exit is the name of a book written by a British. His name is Derek something, and he wrote, this is a kind of a manual, it's a manual for committing suicide. How to die, how to commit suicide, painless. There are several recipes to commit suicide. And the book gave birth to an organization in America and England called the Hemlock Society. Hemlock is the name of a plant. It is very poisonous. And if you study philosophy, there is a story of Socrates. Socrates was sentenced to death, and he chose to die by himself. by committing suicide. Although he can escape, he refused to escape. But he chose to drink hemlock. And so hemlock became a symbol, symbolism of death with dignity. So there are many people who are fighting for a right to die. And also euthanasia. Eu is a prefix in Greek language. It means good. Thana. Thanas means death, good death. It means die by putting to death by somebody else. Death with mercy killing. And another thing is physician assisted suicide. It's halfway. You kill yourself. You take the pills in your own mouth. But the pills are prepared by doctors. So there are many, many people who believe that they should have the right to die. And in a state like Oregon, in the United States, there is a law which allow patients who suffer from incurable disease at a terminal state to choose to have physician assisted suicide. For people who don't believe, they just said you happen to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. They don't think too much. Or that's life. Simple as that. Now, I bring into you a summary of the teaching of Buddha. The Buddha said, all my teaching concerned with two things, dukkha and its solution. And the word dukkha has been left untranslated in many Buddhist countries and have been used with the term for a long time. But when Buddhism get in touch with Western country, Western culture, they ask the question, what does it mean? And many people translate it as suffering, some people as pain, some people as dissatisfaction. So I did some research on the word dukkha, and I found that it gives a very good meaning if you understand the origin of the word. The origin is a Prakrit word. Prakrit is the ancient language of India. And the word dukkha was a technical term used among craftsmen who work with carts and tools. And it describes a situation when two objects, two pieces of tool, which are supposed to fit in with each other, fail to do so. When they fail to do so, that situation is called dukkha. For example, a wheel of a cart broke down and the hole of the wheel in the hub couldn't fit in with the axis. Some one is bigger than the other, they have different size. That is dukkha. And in English there is an idiom to put a square peg into a round hole. You see? Or to put a round peg into a square hole. They don't fit in. Now the more you try to put them forcefully, the more dukkha you have. This is the nature. And the Buddha adopted the words into Buddhism as a key of its teaching. So it described many situations. Possibly the word pain, suffering, or dissatisfaction does not illustrate the deeper dimension of the word. It's far. His philosophical meaning is deeper than that. It describes not only dukkha in your mind, but also relationship. When relationship is broken, they do not fit in with each other anymore. Expectation of one party do not fit in with the rest. So that is dukkha. Or when there you detect a kind of management in a corporation, when there is a conflict, you can detect there is dukkha there too. Or it can be used for scientific discovery and many things else. Now, what is life? When do we know that life's end? You see, in Tipitaka there was no clear-cut point which allow Buddhists to decide when life ends. There was no criteria used by physicians in those days. It doesn't fit in very well with us. However, in commentary of Vinayas is a kind of monastic discipline used among Buddhist monks. It described that human life starts with first awareness immediately when conception begins, and its end, it lasts 120 years. Now, how can you use this definition? This definition cannot help much for diagnose a case of death and dying. Now, I have to say, my curiosity in social dimension of Buddhism started when I worked with my thesis on death, on AIDS and Buddhism in Thailand. That was my thesis, and it was very curious because in those days Thailand was called capital of AIDS, world AIDS capital of the world. There are a lot of problems inside. We have a lot of prostitutes, we have a lot of brothels there. There was one woman who is American woman who spent two years studying Buddhism in Thailand. And he came back and we read a paper, and it amazed me, because formerly I was just interested in meditation and nothing else. And she said, it is very interesting that Buddhists in Thailand, although the Buddha said that this is not good, is it bad, prostitution is bad, gambling is bad, but there are a lot of these wives in Thailand, some brothels just next door to a temple, and monks there, the abbot pay no attention to it, except as fact. So when I come back to Thailand, I have an opportunity to teach a very large gathering of Buddhists who have been practicing Buddhism for over 10 years. And I raise a question to them, what will you do if you found that one day you found that your neighbor convert his or her house into a brothel? The answer, the first answer that I received was nothing. Because as soon as I realized the problems, I entered into vipassana meditation, realizing impermanence, dukkha, no self, the problem is gone. Enter seeing the nature that is impermanent. Things are impermanent, is suffering by nature, is dukkha, having no substance. I detach. Problem gone. This is a very, very clear-cut way to solve problem. As soon as it arises, it's gone. But the brothel's still there. Problem unattended. The second group of Buddhists said, we can't do anything. We know that the brothel is bad business, but you see, those prostitutes, they were former playboys, adulterers. They have affairs with women, and they spent 500 lifetime in hell. Spending 500 time in hell, they were reborn again as animal, being castrated 500 times. After spending time like animal castrated 500 times, they were reborn again as gays, homosexuals, and spent another 500 times like gay and homosexual. After that, they become prostitutes 500 times. After 500 times of being prostitute, they become good women, housewife. Spending another 500 times as good housewife, finally they become men. Men are on top. We can't intervene because they're receiving the fruition of their karma. Although we know, we sympathize with them, but we cannot help. No engagement. I detect that what is described fit in with, I found in a book described by Melford Spiro. He is a social anthropologist in America. He worked 14 months in Burma, and he wrote a systematic analysis. He found that there are several types of Buddhism. Buddhism is not a monolithic religion. It has several subsets inside. The first one he called Nibbanic Buddhism, religion of radical salvation. Second, Karmatic Buddhism, religion of proximate salvation. These two groups are majorities in Burma. And Apotropic Buddhism is religion of magical protection. And Esoteric Buddhism is religion of chiastic expectation. Chiastic, they expect the coming of the next Buddha. Now these are four major subsets, of Theravada Buddhism in Myanmar. The upper two are the majorities. You see, what I just found from my investigation, we found that fit in with Nibbanic and Karmatic Buddhism. The Nibbanic guys feel that there are three dominating principle: impermanence, suffering, and no self. The goal of life is to attain nirvana in life. The principle of practice is morality, mental concentration, and wisdom. And merit or demerit should be detached. You shouldn't live life to accumulate merit or demerit. They were all impediment. Ideal life of living a Nibbanic lifestyle is being a forest monk, and not to do with materialism. For Karmatic Buddhists, they see that karma, the law of karma, rules the world. You see, for Nibbanic Buddhists, they feel that everything is suffering. Life is bad as by nature. But Karmatic Buddhists see that justice rules the world. Everything is just. Good things, you have rewards, and bad things lead to punishment. The goal is maximize merit, attain rebirth. Again, the principle is charity, morality, and meditation. Monks are fields of merit. Merit is a spiritual treasure, the real thing that one can take to next life. Ideal living is a rich, virtuous businessman, a king, or powerful person. These are two extremes. Apotropic Buddhism is a smaller group, but they think that the world is full of supernatural phenomena. The goal is for current living through rites and ritual. The practice is monks' service in Pali chanting and to transform the life through merit or power of the triple gems. Ideal living is living in trouble-free world with blessing surrounded by good omens. Esoteric Buddhists, on the other hand, they wait for the fifth Buddha, Maitreya, to come. So they either look for medication that would allow them to live a long time, or some form of meditation that allow them to live very long life. Now, I found death a different meaning. If you are Nibbanic type, death is a natural process. Life is painful, is suffering. Death is invisible. If you are Karmatic Buddhist, you see death as a result of karmic retribution. You see? So, how do you think? Either of them did hardly pay attention to helping others, because they see no dimension, no relationship with society, whatever. So that is problem in society. And Spiro conclude in his book that there is no social consciousness in Buddhism. So there are many problems unattended in Theravada world. Now, I disagree with that, but I found a lot of useful information given by Spiros. I found there are ways to understand social dimension of Buddhism, and that is through Mangala. Mangala associates person with the society and with the future. And through adoption of Mangala, 38 Mangalas, we can help society and people who are in pain. So I found a death, the criteria for a justification of death in the first precept. Panatipata Veramani, abstention from taking life. Technically, it is abstention from causing the falling away of life force, prana. The word prana comes from Sanskrit prana. It's a technical term used in a book called Charaka Samhita. It's a manuscript of doctors there. When prana is its life force, is situated in the heart muscles. The prana empower thinking, swallowing, and breathing. So when we know now that swallowing and thinking and breathing were the work controlled by cerebral cortex and brainstem functions. So when the patient die, brain death, justification, the loss of prana. When the brain stop function, the cortical function of the brain and the brainstem stop functioning, that is also justification for dying, physical dying, according to Charaka Samhita. So according to Nibbanic Buddhism, life is suffering. Pain, dissatisfaction is the nature, everyone for himself. You cannot help others. You have to help yourself. Equanimity is the highest virtue. Perception of problem in society affirms life is full of suffering. And there's no society or individuals living together. For Gamatic also, they see life as a process of karma in the past life. Everyone has to do for himself. Happiness of good merit, of merit done. Suffering of the merit. But what agree with Nibbanic and Gamatic is that there is no society. You do for yourself. How are these for the end of life care? In the world, people who die suddenly of accident, heart attack, of being killed, averagely 8.9% of people die suddenly without warning. The rest 91.1% die with slow causes of illness, like cancer, AIDS, vital organ failures. But the problems at the end of life care, who going to decide? The doctor, the physician, or the family? And who going to decide when to stop? There are two forms of philosophy of treatment in medicine. One is called curative, and the other is palliative. Curative is you go down to the cause and try to uproot the cause of illness. And then palliative is to stop all the aggressive treatment and to take care of the patient. Taking patient as a center, giving comfort as much as possible. The process of death, this is a common process of death. It doesn't always happen like this, but majority of people who are dying have this experience. It happened the first 2 to 3 months before dying. The patient suffered from appetite loss. He or she start refusing food and drinks. This is a time when the family got very upset, alert, and worried, and the patient spent more time sleeping, more and more start to withdraw. And then a very interesting thing is to start seeing dead people. Sometimes these images can interact, can talk to them too. And then more and more withdrawn, more and more prolonged sleeping and start to disorientate. And a few days before die, one or two days, he or she gets better. Good orientation, remember everyone correctly. And start eating the food that he or she loves, and suddenly weaken and expire. It's a natural process of dying. In preparation of death, medically, the doctors has to judge when to stop curative, when to say enough is enough. From curative to palliative, when to stop giving chemotherapy, which will weaken the patients, causing more trouble, and then start giving morphine, treating pain, giving good oral care, or to discharge from hospital and allow the patient to stay at home. Most patients like to die at home. When there was a research done in the United States, around the world, the preference of people would like to die at home, not at hospital. But the family would like to treat the patient in hospital for many reasons. Because first they think that it could be cured. They believe some family member believe that life should be saved at all costs. But some, they're afraid of ghosts. They fear that their mother or father will die at home. The ghost will be there and not good. With bad luck. And some just want to keep because they don't know what to do. They were in frustration. And we found in Thailand, the most important problem is pain management. Most doctors didn't want to give morphine. Give very small dose. And they think that even the patient has only 2 months of survival. They're afraid that giving morphine will make them addicted. There'll be a problem of morphine addiction. The patient has 2 months. Why to worry about addiction? You see? And a simple question, the oral care. The most common symptom after pain is oral care. Dry mouth is the most disturbing feeling of people who are dying. And it can be simply treated by giving good, more oral care. Home care is also good. Allow the patient to die at home. Train members of the family to be good nurse, caregiver. And the one we found in Thailand, very common after 1997. We have a bubble burst of economy, financial support. In 1997, the rate of suicide in Thailand is 1 suicide per hour throughout the country. It was so bad. And most common complaint, the family of the patient said, financial need is very important. The second is psychological care. Most doctors look over this and never pay attention. Social and family, very important. Many people before they died, they have broken relationship. It's duty to bring those relatives who have been away, left the patient to come and say goodbye, to offer thanks and forgiveness to each other. Spiritual care is often neglected in Thailand. Legal preparation, and lastly, bereavement. These are 6 factors of holistic care for people who are dying. Bereavement is the care of the survival. Those people who lost their loved ones unexpectedly or violently still retain scar in their mind. They are injured. If they are little children, they have grown up with a sense of emptiness. They lost trust in people. And these people will have a bad time socializing. They don't want to give love to anyone because they felt they don't know whether they will be betrayed. And if you share no love with other people, what will happen? What will happen is that you trust no one, so you cannot grow in society. In our society, we need trust. To form a community, we have to trust one another. But here, the relationship is injured from the beginning. Then the child has a very dim future. And if the bereavement process was not commenced correctly, finally, it will lead to a very bad future, bad omen for the person. So ethics at the twilight zone. You have to have a clear-cut protocol when to switch from palliative to curative, when to say, that is enough, doctor. Let our mother, let our father, let the patient stay in peace and be comfort. And also truth-telling, who is going to tell? How? And what happened if the patient could not cope with bad news? Or the family couldn't cope with bad news? Whether to issue do not resuscitation order, DNR. When we say, you don't want any aggressive maneuver anymore. And also problem medical team. Whether we are trained and share a similar view, whether some patient, some doctor believe in curative philosophy, that means I want to treat to save life at all costs, or I just want to turn to palliative medicine immediately. Or whether there is problem in family, we need to be help. Whether you should use morphine or not. Some patient will think morphine is get me addicted, so in my next life I'll be addicted to morphine. They prefer not to have morphine, and they have a lot of pain. In Thailand, many patients endure pain because they feel that endurance is good, forbearance is good. So bear pain, when doctor comes and asks them, are you okay? And the patient says, yes, I'm okay, no problem. But very painful. And many doctors prefer to give morphine at a time of pain, PRN for pain. So instead of a pain-free, you have pain every 4 hours or 6 hours. So the ethic of keeping morphine is very important. And who is going to decide all of this? That is the problem. Different facing different society. And who is going to take care of the survivor? And how far? Legal document is very important. In America, they have a law which advocate advanced directive. Advanced directive is a document that the patient writes. The patient writes in exercise of a personal rights of autonomy. And it said, I don't want CPR or have the DNR order issues, and it describes when to let go, when to go to hospice. And in some disease, for example, the patient cannot decide for themselves, they pass the power of decision to another person. In some cases, like Alzheimer, you lost your memory. You couldn't remember even your wife, even your husband. You don't know what's happening to you. Then who and how you're going to decide for yourself. So some people with history of Alzheimer's pass this decision making authority to the third person, to loved one or to other physician. I'd like to suggest you read a book called Tuesday with Maury. It's a New York Times bestseller for many years. It's been produced into a movie by ABC, American Broadcasting Corporation, and broadcast about 3 or 4 years ago. It became a social movement for end-of-life care in the United States. The story was that there was a professor whose name was Maury Schwartz. He was the professor at a university called Brandeis, Boston, Massachusetts. He was diagnosed of ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. It's very slow, painful death. It's motor neuron failure. The muscles fail to work, starting from one foot. It has different pattern. For him, it starts from his foot, spread upward until he couldn't breathe at all and he died. He died in peace. But before he died, he had a kind of a session with his ex-student. And he questioned, you know, many things. And the story tells you how to treat the meaning of life. And Professor Maury faced death wisely and with delight and happiness. He was not at all demoral. He was very, very strong, and he sees that he has his own life philosophy. And he felt that when you know how to die, you know how to live. So this is a good movie and it's a good book. In America, patient who has less than 6 months of prognosis will be allocated to hospice. Hospice is a community care, charity based. 85% of hospice staff are volunteers, and 80 to 85% of them are home care, not institutionalized. It is a holistic treatment with cultural sensitivity. The goal is one: peaceful, painless death. And center in the family with child care and bereavement. So hospice staff will not only pay attention to the quality of life of the patient, but how life is lived in the family of which had lost the patient. At least for another year, there'll be someone who care for those who lost their loved one. Bereavement is done by first detection of victims of loss, not after death has taken place, but before, in preparation for transition, such as healing of broken relationship, and to find ways to replace the lost. You see, many people, many important people, very well-known people, through bereavement, they became a new person. They renewed their life and got well. For example, there was a famous pop star, Paul McCartney. He became a great musician because he played the guitar after he lost his mother. It was a tragic feeling for the boy entering into teenage life. When he lost his mother, he spent time passing time practicing guitar. So we convert bad energy into creativity, and finally through it he became a very good guitarist and good musician and become well famous rock star. So replacement of loss has to be planned, counseling. Moral will is another one. I found that in preparation for dying, for bereavement, if the patient has some loved one and has time to say goodbye, to offer thanks, and to beg for forgiveness or something, better have it done before he or she die. May it be in written document, or in videotape, or in audio tape record. I have a case whom I attended, I treat the patient, and she was 52 years old, a Christian woman who suffered from breast cancer, and she found she has a lump in her breast about 1980. And she received a complete operation, mastectomy, but she lost follow-up, never see a doctor. A year later, she got metastasis. Was so bad, the tumors metastasized into her lung, in her abdomen, intestine, spinal cord, bones. She was living a very miserable life. And she couldn't sleep in a dark room. And when, if someone spoke some bad word or irritated her, she'd get very moody, she'd throw things about. So her family became like hell. When she came to see me, I taught her meditation, probably 15 minutes. But she was very peaceful, and then she thanks me, she returned home, and she meditated very, very dedicatedly. And the day after, I call her again as follow-up phone call, and she said, I never experienced any happiness greater than this in my life. The most beautiful feeling I have. And she was never afraid of death anymore. Before then, she always dreamed of dead parents, that friend who came to see her and persuade her to go with them. And she will incline to go with them also. And after that, no more nightmare. She told me, I know where I'm going to be after I die. I know that I'm going to have a happy death and happy afterlife. I see myself where I'm going to be. And I record her on a video. And I play the video in her funeral. And that was a very good bereavement for her little niece, for many members of her family. And it was a sense that many people cry seeing her face talking in a video, and she said happily, confirmed everyone she lived a good life, and she thanked me that she found happiness through happiness in life through meditation. And that was very useful. So the irony is, the doctor who take care of her died a few weeks before her. He committed suicide. Undecided love affairs. Because he was a very young, good-looking doctor. He had many affairs with many nurses. Couldn't decide who he should get married. And suicide may seem to be an easy way out. You see? And he's the one who told her that she had only about 2 months. Life is full of impermanence. I learned a lot of things from this case. And it was a case that finally allowed me to go to Oxford to study as the first Buddhist monk studying and graduated from Oxford University. Because of that, the family was very happy with me, and they want to do something in return. And one of their friends was a former Prime Minister of Thailand, who wrote me a very strong recommendation. It opened all the doors to Oxford, and that was in 1985. So, and when the person dies, you have to monitor the survivor and try to walk them through. In caregiving, in giving care to people who are dying and to the family, it's not an easy job. It requires not only good philosophy, good dedication, it also is a work of sacrifice. And it also is a good lesson to learn. I benefit a lot from giving care to people who are dying. And I think it is a very important part of society. You see, we care to newborns in the crib, in the nursery, but we thought that people who are dying receive the least care. That is wrong. People who are dying need even more care than newborn babies. Newborn babies hardly have any broken relationship, hardly have a pain, 24 hours, trouble with sleeping, trouble with eating, trouble with talking, communication. Many people, majority of people in America, what they calculate, majority of people in America, more than 80% die in misery, miserable death. See? When our society became more and more materialized, more and more complex, then the care to the dying seemed to be neglected. And in America and in the West, they honor the young people, and they see the old people as no use. They worship the youth and young generation. If you're young and you're successful, then you're great, but not old people. They feel that old people cause trouble, dependency. It's not true. If you have a meaning of life, you will be not afraid of getting old or death. Because getting old means you're more mature. You gain more maturity and you learn more. Understand deeper meaning of life. So people who understand meaning of life shouldn't be getting frustrated or fear of old age, but should enjoy more of learning, because life gives you opportunity to learn. See? So as personally, I think we don't know when we're going to die. Nobody can tell. We may belong to the 8.9% of the world population who die without any warning, without any sign. But if we know how to live, mean we know how to die. We know how to lie, to die, we know how to live. In Buddhism, a good death is not dead in sleep. How many of you want to die in sleep? That is escapism. Good death in Buddhism is death surrounded by love, with time to say goodbye, with time to address your loved one with respect, try to offer with time to say, I love you, I forgive you, and it's a good life. That is closing of a chapter of life. That is a good death. If you die unconscious, that is not a good death in Buddhism. You see? So, in preparation for this, we should learn how to love other people, to expand our love, and we should forgive everyone every day, at all time. A loving consciousness is precious, and we have this loving consciousness at all the time, that is mean we're preparing. We know how to die. If we do this, then that is the way we should live our life. Society would be a much better place if everybody prepared to die wisely. You see? Not to look at the final exit. We die, we use any kind of poison, any kind of drugs, we use gun, or you lock yourself in a garage, being overwhelmed by carbon monoxide. That is not a good death. There is no dignity in doing so. A good death, death with love, compassion, care, forgiveness, offered to everyone. So may include that this is the address, this is the core of holistic care for people who are dying, and it is a very rewarding job, which has been very much neglected in society, sadly to say. In Thailand also, majority of people who die badly, either in pain or in miserable condition. No time to say goodbye, no time to express their love or forgiveness. So we think it's time to make a change of society. You think there's not enough system in society or institution to take care, we should set up one. We should set up a system. We must have volunteer. And it is not so difficult and doesn't require sophisticated machine. But what it requires most is love, compassion, understanding, and time to listen to people, opportunity to allow the ill to express themselves, to say their mind, and focus on them, and treat them as our priority. That is very simple care. Let's see. All right.